Welcome to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Howard's End. E.M. Forster's masterpiece will transport you to turn of the 20th century England, where three families intertwine at a moment in history where industrial progress threatens traditional pastoral life. From the idealistic and cultured Schlegel sisters, the pragmatic Wilcoxes, to the struggling Bests, Marilyn captures them all en route to finding out their fates and that of the iconic house called Howard's End. This is the latest title in our podcast series, Marilyn Lightstone Reads. If this is your first time with us, you can find all the other novels plus new episodes at classicalfm.ca or through your favorite podcast app. Now, let's turn to Marilyn as she reads Howard's End.
Chapter 42. When Charles left Ducie Street, he had caught the first train home, but had no inkling of the newest development until late at night. Then his father, who had dined alone, sent for him and in very grave tones inquired for Margaret.
"I don't know where she is, Peter," said Charles. "Dolly kept back dinner nearly an hour for her."
"Tell me when she comes in." Another hour passed. The servants went to bed, and Charles saw his father again to receive further instructions. Mrs. Wilcox had still not returned.
"I'll sit up for her as late as you like, but she can hardly be coming. Isn't she stopping with her sister at the hotel?"
"Perhaps," said Mr. Wilcox thoughtfully.
"Perhaps. Can I do anything for you, sir?"
"Not tonight, my boy." Mr. Wilcox liked being called sir.
He raised his eyes and gave his son more open a look of tenderness than he usually ventured. He saw Charles as a little boy and strong man in one. Though his wife had proved unstable, his children were left to him. After midnight, he tapped on Charles's door.
"I can't sleep," he said. "I had better have a talk with you and get it over."
He complained of the heat. Charles took him out into the garden, and they paced up and down in their dressing gowns. Charles became very quiet as the story unrolled. He had known all along that Margaret was as bad as her sister.
"She will feel differently in the morning," said Mr. Wilcox,
who had, of course, said nothing about Mrs. Bast.
"But I cannot let this kind of thing continue without comment. I am morally certain that she is with her sister at Howard's End. The house is mine. And, Charles, it will be yours. And when I say that no one is to live there, I mean that no one is to live there. I won't have it."
He looked angrily at the moon.
"To my mind, this question is connected with something far greater. The rights of property itself."
"Undoubtedly," said Charles.
Mr. Wilcox linked his arm in his son's, but somehow liked him less as he told him more.
"I don't want you to conclude that my wife and I have had anything of the nature of a quarrel. She was only overwrought, as who would not be? I shall do what I can for Helen, but on the understanding that they clear out of the house at once. Do you see? That is a sine qua non.
Then at 8 tomorrow I may go up in the car?"
"8 or earlier. Say that you are acting as my representative, and of course use no violence, Charles."
On the morrow, as Charles returned, leaving Leonard dead upon the gravel, it did not seem to him that he had used violence. Death was due to heart disease. His stepmother herself had said so, and even Miss Avery had acknowledged that he only used the flat of the sword. On his way through the village, he informed the police, who thanked him, and said there must be an inquest. He found his father in the garden, shading his eyes from the sun.
"It has been, well, pretty horrible," said Charles gravely. "They were there, and they had the man up there with them, too."
What man?"
"I told you last night. His name was Bast."
"My God, is it possible?" said Mr. Wilcox. "In your mother's house? Charles, in your mother's house?"
"I know, Peter. That was what I felt. As a matter of fact, there is no need to trouble about the man. He was in the last stages of heart disease, and just before I could show him what I thought of him, he went off. The police are seeing about it at this moment."
Mr. Wilcox listened attentively.
"I got up there Oh, it couldn't have been more than 7:30. The Avery woman was lighting a fire for them. They were still upstairs. I waited in the drawing room. We were all moderately civil and collected, though I had my suspicions. I gave them your message, and Mrs. Wilcox said, "Oh, yes, I see, yes," in that way of hers. Nothing else. I promised to tell you, with her love, that she was going to Germany with her sister this evening. That was all we had time for.
Mr. Wilcox seemed relieved.
Because by then, I suppose, the man got tired of hiding, for suddenly Mrs. Wilcox screamed out his name. I recognized it, and I went for him in the hall. Was I right, Peter? I thought things were going a little too far.
Right, my dear boy. I don't know. But you would have been no son of mine if you hadn't. Then did he just crumple up, as you said?
He shrunk from the simple word.
He caught hold of the bookcase, which came down over him. So I merely put the sword down and carried him into the garden. We all thought he was shamming. However, he's dead right enough. Awful business.
Sword?
Cried his father, with anxiety in his voice.
What sword? Whose sword?
A sword of theirs.
What were you doing with it?
Well, didn't you see, Peter? I had to snatch up the first thing handy. I hadn't a riding whip or stick. I caught him once or twice over the shoulders with the flat of their old German sword.
Then what?
He pulled over the bookcase, as I said, and fell, said Charles, with a sigh. It was no fun doing errands for his father, who was never quite satisfied.
But the real cause was heart disease. Of that you're sure?
That or a fit. However, we shall hear more than enough at the inquest on such unsavory topics.
They went into breakfast. Charles had a racking headache, consequent on motoring before food. He was also anxious about the future, reflecting that the police must detain Helen and Margaret for the inquest and ferret the whole thing out. He saw himself obliged to leave Hilton. One could not afford to live near the scene of a scandal. It was not fair on one's wife. His comfort was that the pater's eyes were opened at last. There would be a horrible smash-up, and probably a separation from Margaret. Then they would all start again, more as they had been in his mother's time.
"I think I'll go round to the police station," said his father, when breakfast was over.
"What for?"
cried Dolly, who had still not been told.
"Very well, sir. Which car will you have?"
"I think I'll walk."
"It's a good half mile,"
said Charles, stepping into the garden.
"The sun's very hot for April. Shan't I take you up, and then perhaps a little spin round by Tewin?"
"You go on as if I didn't know my own mind,"
said Mr. Wilcox, fretfully. Charles hardened his mouth.
"You young fellows, one idea is to get into a motor. I tell you, I want to walk. I am very fond of walking."
"Oh, all right. I'm about the house if you want me for anything. I thought of not going up to the office today, if that is your wish."
"It is indeed, my boy,"
said Mr. Wilcox, and laid a hand on his sleeve. Charles did not like it. He was uneasy about his father, who did not seem himself this morning. There was a petulant touch about him, more like a woman. Could it be that he was growing old? The Wilcoxes were not lacking in affection. They had it royally, but they did not know how to use it. It was the talent in the napkin, and for a warm-hearted man, Charles had conveyed very little joy. As he watched his father shuffling up the road, he had a vague regret, a wish that something had been different somewhere. A wish, though he did not express it thus, that he had been taught to say, "I," in his youth. He meant to make up for Margaret's defection, but knew that his father had been very happy with her until yesterday. How had she done it? By some dishonest trick, no doubt, but how? Mr. Wilcox reappeared at 11, looking very tired. There was to be an inquest on Leonard's body tomorrow, and the police required his son to attend.
"I expect that," said Charles. I shall naturally be the most important witness there.
Chapter 43. Out of the turmoil and horror that had begun with Aunt Julie's illness, and was not even to end with Leonard's death, it seemed impossible to Margaret that healthy life should reemerge. Events succeeded in a logical yet senseless train. People lost their humanity and took values as arbitrary as those in a pack of playing cards. It was natural that Henry should do this and cause Helen to do that and then think her wrong for doing it. Natural that she herself should think him wrong. Natural that Leonard should want to know how Helen was and come, and Charles be angry with him for coming. Natural, but unreal. In this jangle of causes and effects, what had become of their true selves? Here Leonard lay, dead in the garden, from natural causes, yet life was a deep, deep river. Death a blue sky. Life was a house, death a wisp of hay, a flower, a tower. Life and death were anything and everything, except this ordered insanity, where the king takes the queen and the ace the king. Ah, no. There was beauty and adventure behind, such as the man at her feet had yearned for. There was hope this side of the grave. There were truer relationships beyond the limits that fetter us now. As a prisoner looks up and sees stars beckoning, so she, from the turmoil and horror of those days, caught glimpses of the diviner wheels. And Helen, dumb with fright but trying to keep calm for the child's sake, and Miss Avery, calm but murmuring tenderly, "No one ever told the lad he'd have a child." They also reminded her that horror is not the end. To what ultimate harmony we tend, she did not know. But there seemed great chance that a child would be born into the world to take the great chances of beauty and adventure that the world offers. She moved through the sunlit garden, gathering narcissi, crimson-eyed and white. There was nothing else to be done. The time for telegrams and anger was over, and it seemed wisest that the hands of Leonard should be folded on his breast and be filled with flowers. Here was the father. Leave it at that. Let squalor be turned into tragedy, whose eyes are the stars and whose hands hold the sunset and the dawn. And even the influx of officials, even the return of the doctor, vulgar and acute, could not shake her belief in the eternity of beauty. Science explained people, but could not understand them. After long centuries among the bones and muscles, it might be advancing to knowledge of the nerves, but this would never give understanding. One could open the heart to Mr. Mansbridge and his sort without discovering its secrets to them, for they wanted everything down in black and white, and black and white was exactly what they were left with. They questioned her closely about Charles. She never suspected why. Death had come, and the doctor agreed that it was due to heart disease. They asked to see her father's sword. She explained that Charles's anger was natural, but mistaken. Miserable questions about Leonard followed, all of which she answered unfalteringly. Then, back to Charles again. "No doubt Mr. Wilcox may have induced death," she said, "but if it wasn't one thing, it would have been another, as you yourselves know." At last they thanked her, and took the sword and the body down to Hilton. She began to pick up the books from the floor. Helen had gone to the farm. It was the best place for her, since she had to wait for the inquest. Though, as if things were not hard enough, Madge and her husband had raised trouble. They did not see why they should receive the offscourings of Howard's End. And, of course, they were right. The whole world was going to be right, and amply avenge any brave talk against the conventions. "Nothing matters," the Schlegels had said in the past, "except one's self-respect and that of one's friends." When the time came, other things mattered terribly. However, Madge had yielded, and Helen was assured of peace for one day and night, and tomorrow she would return to Germany. As for herself, she determined to go too. No message came from Henry. Perhaps he expected her to apologize. Now that she had time to think over her own tragedy, she was unrepentant. She neither forgave him for his behavior nor wished to forgive him. Her speech to him seemed perfect. She would not have altered a word. It had to be uttered once in a life to adjust the lopsidedness of the world. It was spoken not only to her husband, but to thousands of men like him. A protest against the inner darkness in high places that comes with a commercial age. Though he would build up his life without hers, she could not apologize. He had refused to connect on the clearest issue that can be laid before a man, and their love must take the consequences. No, there was nothing more to be done. They had tried not to go over the precipice, but perhaps the fall was inevitable. And it comforted her to think that the future was certainly inevitable. Cause and effect would go jangling forward to some goal, doubtless, but to none that she could imagine. At such moments, the soul retires within, to float upon the bosom of a deeper stream, and has communion with the dead, and sees the world's glory not diminished, but different in kind to what she had supposed. She alters her focus until trivial things are blurred. Margaret had been tending this way all the winter. Leonard's death brought her to the goal. Alas, that Henry should fade away as reality emerged, and only her love for him should remain clear, stamped with his image like the cameos we rescue out of dreams. With unfaltering eye, she traced his future. He would soon present a healthy mind to the world again, and what did he or the world care if he was rotten to the core? He would grow into a rich, jolly old man, at times a little sentimental about women, but emptying his glass with anyone. Tenacious of power, he would keep Charles and the rest dependent, and retire from business reluctantly and at an advanced age. He would settle down, though she could not realize this. In her eyes, Henry was always moving and causing others to move until the ends of the earth met. But in time, he must get too tired to move and settle down. What next? The inevitable word. The release of the soul to its appropriate heaven. Would they meet in it? Margaret believed in immortality for herself. An eternal future had always seemed natural to her. And Henry believed in it for himself. Yet, would they meet again? Are there not rather endless levels beyond the grave, as the theory that he had censured teaches? And his level, whether higher or lower, could it possibly be the same as hers? Thus, gravely meditating, she was summoned by him. He sent up Crane in the motor. Other servants passed like water, but the chauffeur remained, though. And disloyal. Margaret disliked Crane, and he knew it. "Is it the keys that Mr. Wilcox wants?" she asked.
"He didn't say, madam."
"You haven't any note for me?"
"He didn't say, madam."
After a moment's thought, she locked up Howard's End. It was pitiable to see in it the stirrings of warmth that would be quenched forever. She raked out the fire that was blazing in the kitchen and spread the coals in the graveled yard. She closed the windows and drew the curtains. Henry would probably sell the place now. She was determined not to spare him, for nothing new had happened as far as they were concerned. Her mood might never have altered from yesterday evening. He was standing a little outside Charles's gate and motioned the car to stop. When his wife got out, he said hoarsely,
"I prefer to discuss things with you outside."
"It will be more appropriate in the road, I'm afraid," said Margaret. "Did you get my message?"
"What about?"
"I'm going to Germany with my sister. I must tell you now that I shall make it my permanent home. Our talk last night was more important than you have realized. I am unable to forgive you, and am leaving you.
I am extremely tired, said Henry, in injured tones. I have been walking about all the morning and wish to sit down.
Certainly, if you will consent to sit on the grass.
The Great North Road should have been bordered all its length with glebe. Henry's kind had filched most of it. She moved to the scrap opposite wherein were the six hills. They sat down on the farther side so that they could not be seen by Charles or Dolly.
Here are your keys, said Margaret. She tossed them towards him. They fell on the sunlit slope of grass, and he did not pick them up.
I have something to tell you, he said gently.
She knew this superficial gentleness, this confession of hastiness that was only intended to enhance her admiration of the male.
I don't want to hear it, she replied. My sister is going to be ill. My life is going to be with her now. We must manage to build up something, she and I and her child.
Where are you going?
Munich. We start after the inquest, if she is not too ill.
After the inquest?
Yes.
Have you realized what the verdict at the inquest will be?
Yes. Heart disease.
No, my dear. Manslaughter.
Margaret drove her fingers through the grass. The hill beneath her moved as if it was alive.
Manslaughter, repeated Mr. Wilcox. Charles may go to prison. I dare not tell him. I don't know what to do. What to do? I'm broken. I'm ended.
No sudden warmth arose in her. She did not see that to break him was her only hope. She did not enfold the sufferer in her arms, but all through that day and the next, a new life began to move. The verdict was brought in. Charles was committed for trial. It was against all reason that he should be punished, but the law, being made in his image, sentenced him to 3 years' imprisonment. Then Henry's fortress gave way. He could bear no one but his wife. He shambled up to Margaret afterwards and asked her to do what she could with him. She did what seemed easiest. She took him down to recruit at Howard's End.
Chapter 44. Tom's father was cutting the big meadow. He passed again and again amid whirring blades and sweet odors of grass, encompassing with narrowing circles the sacred center of the field. Tom was negotiating with Helen.
I haven't any idea, she replied. Do you suppose baby may, Meg?
Margaret put down her work and regarded them absently.
What was that?
She asked.
Tom wants to know whether baby is old enough to play with hay.
I haven't the least notion, answered Margaret, and took up her work again.
Now, Tom, baby is not to stand. He is not to lie on his face. He is not to lie so that his head wags. He is not to be teased or tickled, and he is not to be cut into two or more pieces by the cutter. Will you be as careful as all that?
Tom held out his arms.
That child is a wonderful nursemaid, remarked Margaret. He is fond of baby, that's why he does it, was Helen's answer. They're going to be lifelong friends.
Starting at the ages of 6 and 1?
Of course. It'll be a great thing for Tom.
It may be a greater thing for baby. 14 months had passed, but Margaret still stopped at Howard's End. No better plan had occurred to her. The meadow was being recut. The great red poppies were reopening in the garden. July would follow with the little red poppies among the wheat. August with the cutting of the wheat. These little events would become part of her year after year. Every summer she would fear lest the well should give out. Every winter lest the pipes should freeze. Every westerly gale might blow the witch elm down and bring the end of all things, and so she could not read or talk during a westerly gale. The air was tranquil now. She and her sister were sitting on the remains of Evie's rockery, where the lawn merged into the field.
"What a time they all are," said Helen. "What can they be doing inside?"
Margaret, who was growing less talkative, made no answer. The noise of the cutter came intermittently, like the breaking of waves. Close by them, a man was preparing to scythe out one of the dell holes.
"I wish Henry was out to enjoy this," said Helen. "This lovely weather, and to be shut up in the house, it's very hard."
"It has to be," said Margaret. "The hay fever is his chief objection against living here, but he thinks it worthwhile."
"Meg, is or isn't he ill? I can't make out."
"Not ill. Eternally tired. He has worked very hard all his life and noticed nothing. Those are the people who collapse when they do notice a thing.
I suppose he worries dreadfully about his part of the tangle."
"Dreadfully. That is why I wish Dolly had not come too today."
"Still, he wanted them all to come. It has to be."
"Why does he want them?"
Margaret did not answer.
"Meg, may I tell you something? I like Henry."
"You'd be odd if you didn't," said Margaret.
"I usen't to."
"Usen't?" She lowered her eyes a moment to the black abyss of the past. They had crossed it, always excepting Leonard and Charles. They were building up a new life, obscure, yet gilded with tranquility. Charles had 2 years more in prison. One usen't always to see clearly before that time. It was different now.
"I like Henry because he does worry.
And he likes you because you don't." Helen sighed. She seemed humiliated and buried her face in her hands. After a time she said, "Above love." A transition less abrupt than it appeared. Margaret never stopped working.
"I mean a woman's love for a man. I supposed I should hang my life onto that once, and was driven up and down and about as if something was worrying through me. But everything is peaceful now. I seem cured. That Herr Forstmeister whom Frieda keeps writing about must be a noble character, but he doesn't see that I shall never marry him or anyone. It isn't shame or mistrust of myself. I simply couldn't. I'm ended. I used to be so dreamy about a man's love as a girl, and think that for good or evil, love must be the great thing. But it hasn't been. It has been itself a dream. Do you agree?"
"I do not agree. I do not."
"I ought to remember Leonard as my lover," said Helen, stepping down into the field. "I tempted him and killed him, and it is surely the least I can do. I would like to throw out all my heart to Leonard on such an afternoon as this, but I cannot. It's no good pretending. I'm forgetting him."
Her eyes filled with tears.
"How nothing seems to match. How, my darling, my precious—"
She broke off.
"Tommy?"
"Yes, please."
"Baby's not to try and stand. There's something wanting in me. I see you loving Henry and understanding him better daily, and I know that death wouldn't part you in the least. But is it some awful, appalling criminal defect?"
Margaret silenced her. She said, "It is only that people are far more different than is pretended. All over the world, men and women are worrying because they cannot develop as they are supposed to develop. Here and there they have the matter out, and it comforts them."
"Oh, don't fret yourself, Helen. Develop what you have. Love your child. I do not love children. I'm to have none. I can play with their beauty and charm, but that's all. Nothing real. Not one scrap of what there ought to be. And others. Others go farther still, and move outside humanity altogether. A place, as well as a person, may catch the glow. Don't you see that all this leads to comfort in the end? It is part of the battle against sameness. Differences, eternal differences, planted by God in a single family, so that there may always be color. Sorrow, perhaps, but color in the daily gray. Then I can't have you worrying about Leonard. Don't drag in the personal when it will not come. Forget him.
Yes, yes. But what has Leonard got out of life?
Perhaps an adventure.
Is that enough?
Or not for us, but for him.
Helen took up a bunch of grass. She looked at the sorrel and the red and white and yellow clover, and the Quaker grass and the daisies and the bents that composed it. She raised it to her face.
Is it sweetening yet?
Asked Margaret.
No, only withered.
It will sweeten tomorrow.
Helen smiled.
Oh, Meg, you are a person, she said. Think of the racket and torture this time last year. But now I couldn't stop unhappy if I tried. What a change, and all through you.
Oh, we merely settled down.
You and Henry learned to understand one another and to forgive, all through the autumn and the winter.
Yes, but who settled us down?
Margaret did not reply. The scything had begun, and she took off her pince-nez to watch it.
You, cried Helen. You did it all, sweetest, though you're too stupid to see. Living here was your plan. I wanted you, he wanted you, and everyone said it was impossible. But you knew.
Just think of our lives without you, Meg. I and the baby with Monica, revolting by theory. He handed about from Dolly to Evie.
But you picked up the pieces and made us a home.
Can't it strike you, even for a moment, that your life has been heroic? Can't you remember the 2 months after Charles's arrest when you began to act and did all?
You were both ill at the time, said Margaret. I did the obvious things. I had 2 invalids to nurse. Here was a house, already furnished and empty. It was obvious. I didn't know myself it would turn into a permanent home. No doubt I have done a little towards straightening the tangle, but things that I can't phrase have helped me.
I hope it will be permanent, said Helen, drifting away to other thoughts.
I think so. There are moments when I feel Howards End peculiarly our own. All the same, London's creeping.
She pointed over the meadow. Over 8 or 9 meadows, but at the end of them was a red rust.
You see that in Surrey and even Hampshire now,
she continued.
I can see it from the Purbeck Downs, and London is only part of something else, I'm afraid. Life is going to be melted down all over the world.
Margaret knew that her sister spoke truly.
Howards End, Honiton, the Purbeck Downs, the Oderberg were all survivals, and the melting pot was being prepared for them. Logically, they had no right to be alive. One's hope was in the weakness of logic. Were they possibly the earth beating time?
Because a thing is going strong now, it need not go strong forever, she said. This craze for motion is only set in during the last 100 years. It may be followed by a civilization that won't be a movement, because it will rest on the earth. All the signs are against it now, but I can't help hoping, and very early in the morning in the garden, I feel that our house is in the future, as well as the past.
They turned and looked at it. Their own memories colored it now, for Helen's child had been born in the central room of the 9. Then Margaret said,
Oh, take care!
For something moved behind the window of the hall, and the door opened.
The conclave's breaking at last. I'll go.
It was Paul. Helen retreated with the children far into the field. Friendly voices greeted her. Margaret rose to encounter a man with a heavy black moustache.
My father has asked for you, he said with hostility.
She took her work and followed him.
We have been talking business, he continued, but I dare say you knew all about it beforehand.
Yes, I did.
Clumsy of movement, for he had spent all his life in the saddle, Paul drove his foot against the paint of the front door. Mrs. Wilcox gave a little cry of annoyance. She did not like anything scratched. She stopped in the hall to take Dolly's boa and gloves out of a vase. Her husband was lying in a great leather chair in the dining room, and by his side, holding his hand rather ostentatiously, was Evie. Dolly, dressed in purple, sat near the window. The room was a little dark and airless, They were obliged to keep it like this until the carting of the hay. Margaret joined the family without speaking. The five of them had already met at tea, and she knew quite well what was going to be said. Averse to wasting her time, she went on sewing. The clock struck six.
"Is this going to suit everyone?" said Henry, in a weary voice.
He used the old phrases, but their effect was unexpected and shadowy.
"Because I don't want you all coming here later on and complaining that I have been unfair."
"It's apparently got to suit us," said Paul.
"I beg your pardon, my boy. You have only to speak, and I will leave the house to you instead."
Paul frowned ill-temperedly and began scratching at his arm.
"As I have given up the outdoor life that suited me, and I have come home to look after the business, it's no good my settling down here,"
he said at last.
"It's not really the country, and it's not the town."
"Very well. Does my arrangement suit you, Evie?"
"Of course, father."
"And you, Dolly?"
Dolly raised her faded little face, which sorrow could wither, but not steady.
"Perfectly splendidly," she said. "I thought Charles wanted it for the boys, but last time I saw him he said no, because we cannot possibly live in this part of England again. Charles says we ought to change our name, but I cannot think what to, for Wilcox just suits Charles and me, and I can't think of any other name."
There was a general silence. Dolly looked nervously round, fearing that she had been inappropriate. Paul continued to scratch his arm.
"Then I leave Howards End to my wife absolutely," said Henry, "and let everyone understand that. And after I am dead, let there be no jealousy and no surprise."
Margaret did not answer. There was something uncanny in her triumph. She, who had never expected to conquer anyone, had charged straight through these Wilcoxes and broken up their lives.
"In consequence, I leave my wife no money," said Henry. "That is her own wish. All that she would have had will be divided among you. I am also giving you a great deal in my lifetime, so that you may be independent of me. That is her wish, too. She also is giving away a great deal of money. She intends to diminish her income by half during the next 10 years. She intends, when she dies, to leave the house to her nephew down in the field. Is all that clear? Does everyone understand?"
Paul rose to his feet. He was accustomed to natives, and very little shook him out of the Englishman. Feeling manly and cynical, he said,
"Down in the field? Oh, come, I think we might have had the whole establishment, pickaninnies included."
Mrs. Cahill whispered,
"Don't, Paul. You promised you'd take care."
Feeling a woman of the world, she rose and prepared to take her leave. Her father kissed her.
"Goodbye, old girl," he said. "Don't you worry about me."
"Goodbye, Dad."
Then it was Dolly's turn. Anxious to contribute, she laughed nervously and said,
"Goodbye, Mr. Wilcox. It does seem curious that Mrs. Wilcox should have left Margaret Howard's End, and yet she get it after all."
From Evie came a sharply drawn breath.
"Goodbye,"
she said to Margaret, and kissed her. And again fell the word, like the ebb of a dying sea.
"Goodbye."
"Goodbye, Dolly."
"So long, father."
"Goodbye, my boy. Always take care of yourself."
"Goodbye, Mrs. Wilcox." "Goodbye."
Margaret saw their visitors to the gate. Then she returned to her husband and laid her head in his hands. He was pitiably tired, but Dolly's remark had interested her. At last she said,
"Could you tell me, Henry, what was that about Mrs. Wilcox having left me Howards End?"
Tranquilly he replied,
"Yes, she did, but that is a very old story. When she was ill, and you were so kind to her, she wanted to make you some return, and not being herself at the time, scribbled Howards End on a piece of paper. I went into it thoroughly, and as it was clearly fanciful, I set it aside.
little knowing what my Margaret would be to me in the future."
Margaret was silent. Something shook her life in its inmost recesses, and she shivered.
"I didn't do wrong, did I?"
he asked, bending down.
"You didn't, darling. Nothing has been done wrong." From the garden came laughter.
"Here they are at last," exclaimed Henry, disengaging himself with a smile.
Helen rushed into the gloom, holding Tom by one hand and carrying her baby on the other. There were shouts of infectious joy.
"The field's cut," Helen cried excitedly. "The big meadow. We've seen to the very end, and it'll be such a crop of hay as never."
Weybridge, 1908 to 1910. Howards End. Author, E. M. Forster.
Thank you for listening to Marilyn Lightstone Reads Howards End. This episode was produced by Duncan Briggs, executive producer Moses Neimer. This is the latest book in our podcast series, Marilyn Lightstone Reads. Other novels in the series include Sense and Sensibility, The Secret Garden, Anne of Green Gables, Pride and Prejudice, Vanity Fair, and Showboat. You can find them all at classicalfm.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also help support this podcast by recommending it to your friends and leaving a 5-star review in your preferred podcast store. And while you're there, look for a variety of other quality podcasts proudly presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network.